changed all I ever knew. Only you.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 5 o'clock. This is Justine Green. The UK has joined 10 other countries and the European Union in calling for a 21-day ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. The statement followed an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council, during which the Secretary-General Antonio Guterres said all hell is breaking loose in Lebanon. Israel's most senior general has told his troops to prepare for a ground offensive across the border. Mr. Guterres called for an immediate end to the hostilities.
All-out war must be avoided at all costs. It would surely be an all-out catastrophe. The people of Lebanon, as well as the people of Israel and the people of the world, cannot afford Lebanon to become another Gaza.
The BBC understands that one of the richest people in the world, Elon Musk, has not been invited to the government's International Investment Summit next month. Sources say it's because of the billionaire's social media posts during last month's riots, which were described at the time by ministers as utterly deplorable. Network Rail says there was a cyber attack on the public Wi-Fi network at 20 railway stations. Customers were directed to websites containing what the company says was inappropriate material before their Wi-Fi was suspended. An investigation into what happened is underway, as our transport correspondent Sean Dilley explains.
The focus now is to understand how cyber attackers managed to get hold of the Wi-Fi network and target it in the first place. But the BBC understands that it's unlikely customer data has been compromised because no personal information is asked before users are connected.
Campaigners are calling for one of the UK's largest food certification schemes to be dropped, claiming it's failing to enforce legal standards. RSPCA assured labels supermarket food to tell shoppers if they're buying higher welfare meat, eggs, fish and dairy. But undercover inspectors say they found welfare issues at around 40 farms. The RSPCA has said it's launched an investigation and wider review of the scheme and has introduced random spot checks. An independent think tank has suggested a radical overhaul of student loans and university funding in England to make the system fairer. The Higher Education Policy Institute wants to see better maintenance support and a national insurance charge for graduate employers. The government has yet to set out its long-term plans for funding universities in England. Here's our education editor, Bramwyn Jeffries.
Students starting university this year in England will be expected to repay their loans for up to 40 years after graduation. This report calls for the repayment term to be cut to 20 years before the loans are written off. It also says maintenance grants should be brought back. The report recognises there is little public appetite for raising tuition fees. Instead, it says adding 1% to national insurance payments from graduate employers would help generate extra funding.
And the weather: showers may become thundery in the south. Elsewhere, cloudy with the odd shower and windy across the north. BBC News, it's 3 minutes past five.
You've probably got a list of things your child needs for uni. Pans, cutlery, sheets, duvet, towels, you know. But this is a little reminder that they'll also need a TV licence to be covered to watch all the TV channels, live TV on streaming services and BBC iPlayer. On the downside, it's one more thing on your list. On the upside, you can continue to enjoy your favourite shows together on the family group chat. And they won't be bringing it home to be washed either. To find out more, search TV licence uni.
Wake Up to Money from BBC Five Live.
Hello and welcome to Wake Up to Money. It's Freshers Week for thousands of students across the UK, but looming over the excitement is the dark cloud of growing financial pressures from heading off to uni. We'll take a look at the concerns facing freshers and their parents. I'm prepared to take huge risks. That's what the boss of the Formula One racing team Williams has told me. We'll hear my chat with James Vowles shortly, including when he thinks his once champion team will start winning races once again. And instant noodles are seeing a resurgence thanks to social media. We'll speak to one retailer who's seen their sales jump 50%.
Wake Up to Money from BBC Radio 5 Live.
Good morning, and welcome to Wake Up to Money. It's Thursday, 26th of September. It's just after 5 o'clock. I'm Theo Leggett with you for the next hour. And they do say Thursday is the new Friday, so reasons to be cheerful. And if the thought of instant noodles at 5am doesn't bring back memories of heady university days, I don't know what will. We want to hear from you. Tell us what you think about university fees and student debt. It's really an interesting one, this. Many students and parents say it's either becoming unaffordable to go to university or already is. But on the other hand, just last week, the president of Universities UK, Dame Sally Mapston, said tuition fees weren't high enough at the moment to cover what they need to, and universities need more money. You can get in touch with us on text. 850-58 is the number, or we're on WhatsApp. 080-85-909-693. And I'm on social media. The handle is at TheoTheBald. Just look at the picture, you'll understand why. So with me this morning, I have my normal two guests. We have Arania Robinson, Chief Executive Officer at Quiet Storm Advertising Agency. You might have seen some of their ads for Haribo and On the Beach and other things on television. Good morning, Arania.
Morning, Theo.
Lovely to have you with us. And also we have April LaRousse, who's Head of Investment Specialists at Insight Investments. Good morning, April. Do you have your cup of coffee with you?
I did. I already drank it, I'm afraid, though. I need another one.
And I hear you have a special interest in one of our stories this morning because your daughter's just started at university. It's Freshers Week.
Yes, that's right. She seems to be merrily spending her way through the money I gave her, so she's having a good time.
Well, we'll expect you to be pithy and controversial on that one then, April. But we'll start off with Arania. Arania, welcome back to the show. How has business been since we last spoke with you, which I think was a few months ago?
Yeah, actually business has picked up for us. We've had, our clients have been sort of actively spending throughout, but what we're seeing a shift in is actually new business opportunities seem to be coming through again, where after a period of where it was very sort of quiet. So I think brands are either just fed up with sitting on their hands or, I recognize that there is consumer confidence still is a bit shaky, but I think brands are just fed up with sitting on their hands.
And in your industry, getting hold of the right people is really, really important. What's the labor market like for you?
We're hiring at the moment. So from a personal perspective, it's, you know, there's more of a demand. And I think that's something anecdotally is coming through with other people we're talking to. But there is also still a lot of layoffs happening and consolidation going on in our industry. So it's a kind of employer's market, I would say, still, because there's lots more candidates out there.
And in the advertising industry, first impressions are always said to be crucial. We're still in the state of having first impressions of the new government. And it's the Labour Party has really been accused of spreading a bit too much doom and gloom with the language it's been using. We've had the Labour Party conference, obviously. As a small, relatively small business, Is this something that resonates with you?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of anticipation around what actually comes out through the budget. But I think, you know, what the new government is very supportive of is the creative industries. So there's some positivity personally on a personal level for us there. But of course, you know, we're hoping that they're going to, put a budget through that is not going to negatively impact small to medium sized businesses, because there's obviously a risk in that. We're all holding our breath for that.
So it's all to be heard in the budget, isn't it? But obviously This week we did hear from Keir Starmer, we did hear from Rachel Reeves, and the message has very much been that we'll see pain before we see long-term gains. There are lots of difficult decisions to take. What are your thoughts on what you heard?
Yeah, I mean, taxation is obviously a key area that is going to be targeted, presumably, which I think we're all anticipating. What that actually means in practice is still quite ambiguous. I think there's lots of speculation. So, it's very hard to form a final judgment on it without seeing what the actual plans are. To me, it feels quite contradictory, some of the headlines, honestly, because, you know, there's also this headline around not wanting to return to austerity. And obviously, if there's too much pressure put on businesses and you know, taxation, then that is going to have an impact. So it's a bit vague, I'd say.
OK, I want to bring April in here now. So, April, what's been catching your fancy this morning? What's your preoccupation?
Oh, goodness. I was having a look at the OECD comments about UK growth, and they're saying that actually things are going to be more optimistic, or at least when they're making some forecasts about how the UK looks relative to other large economies. So I'm hoping that the new government will be thinking about how any plans that they make on investment could feed into making that actually happen.
Okay, well, we'll chat a little bit more about that later on. But first of all, I want to talk about Boeing, the US plane maker, of course. It's in the news again, this time because of a warning from the US safety regulator, the Federal Aviation Administration. Mike Whitaker, the head of the FAA, has been testifying before politicians in the US Senate. And he said that he won't let the company boost production until it addresses a series of serious safety issues. Democrat lawmakers also released the results of a staff survey carried out by Boeing in May, which showed that many workers on the shop floor still felt pressure to build planes quickly, and that this was causing a lowering of standards on the production line. I'm joined now by Ed Pearson, who's executive director of the Foundation for Aviation Safety. He's also a former senior manager at Boeing's plant in Renton in Washington State, where they build the 737 MAX. Good morning, Ed. Well, good evening for you.
Good evening, Theo. Good morning. Back to you.
So you've obviously been watching the testimony in Congress this week. What's your takeaway?
Well, obviously, the Congress is trying to reassure the public and really get the sense that the Boeing company and the FAA are taking the necessary steps. But I found the hearing to be really anything but reassuring. I think the steps that the FAA has been taking are very weak. And it's very unfortunate because this is clearly a global safety issue.
We should say, though, that the FAA has imposed a quality and safety improvement plan on Boeing, hasn't it? Boeing was given a limited amount of time to come up with it. It's now supposedly focused on achieving those quality control and safety improvements.
Right. There's several elements that they spoke about, and if I could very quickly just touch upon. So there's a cap of 38 production of MAX airplanes a month. The problem with that is the company hasn't been able to produce consistently more than 23 a month the entire year. So that's a meaningless cap. They focus on these things they call key performance indicators, which are basically data metrics that are supposed to be kind of a tripwire to warning you that something's bad. We had dozens and dozens of these metrics in place before the MAX disasters. They just weren't used by executives. They always rationalize going around them to meet schedule. They also talk about these aviation safety inspectors on site. You know, you have to understand this site has literally thousands of employees working 7 days a week, three shifts, and the FAA has deployed, get this, 11 employees into that factory after two fatal crashes, after another almost fatal crash, after $20 billion loss to the company. And the FAA's regional headquarters is 20 minutes down Highway 405. They have 800 people there. And there's 45,000 people in the FAA, and they can only deploy 11 people into the factory. And these individuals, you know, when people hear aviation safety inspector, I think it conjures up an image that these are actually people going out doing detailed inspections of aircraft systems and structures. And that's not the case. These individuals are really auditors. They're going out and checking paperwork, checking the process. So it's really unfair to kind of make it sound like they're doing all this enhanced oversight. And we found this to be very discouraging, and it's really in many ways just an illusion of safety, and that's what concerns us.
And yet the FAA is under huge amounts of pressure itself, isn't it? Because 5 years ago, there were the two terrible accidents involving the 737 MAX. After that, there was an awful lot of bad press, not just for Boeing, but also for the FAA. There were accusations that the regulator had been of regulatory capture, that the regulator had kind of been taken over by Boeing, that it didn't have the power to regulate its biggest customer, if you like. Mike Whitaker has become head of the organization since then. He's under a huge amount of pressure, isn't he, to sort this out and get it right this time?
You know, he is under a huge amount of pressure, actually the entire organization of the FAA. And I would add to that the Department of Transportation, because ultimately the Department of Transportation oversees the FAA. And we haven't heard a peep out of the Department of Transportation, have no idea what they're doing. And really, you know, when you talk about pressure, the real pressure is that we're building airplanes that are questionable quality. The FAA is saying this is going to take years to fix the culture. And we, you know, passengers and flight crew and the public, you know, that's not acceptable, right? We need fixes today. We need aggressive action today. We, as our foundation, were very disappointed also because we had provided the committee, the Senate committee, questions and documents, official documents that show that the Boeing company knew more about that second plane MAX crash than they had provided to the investigators. There was clear evidence of electrical failures in that plane. And we provided these documents to the Senate, hoping that they would ask the FAA administrator about this. And they didn't do that. So, you know, overall, it just seems like there's a lot of talk and not a lot of action.
Yeah, I should say at this point that Boeing does contest some of those claims, but I take your point. Meanwhile, Boeing, of course, has to contend with a major strike in the Pacific Northwest, some 30,000 employees on strike over pay and conditions. And there does seem to be a real mismatch between management and staff, a sort of breakdown in trust. What impact is that going to have on any attempts to improve safety and quality control on the shop floor?
Well, the union members, what they're asking for actually is very reasonable considering the losses that they've taken over the several years. And they've had their pension removed. They're asked to spend more money on their health care. There's been a lot of pressure placed on these individuals. Their training that they're receiving is really not where it should be. And, you know, if you compensate employees properly, you're going to retain talent and people are going to want to stay for a career, especially if they have a pension, which a lot of these individuals, they come from families that worked at Boeing and their families, their grandparents had pensions. And this was all removed. And so this is a problem that has been management. This has been a management generated problem. And these employees are the most important resource of the company by far. And, you know, it's pretty telling when the machinists take time off or the engineers in the SPIA union decide, you know, when they decide to strike, nothing gets done at the Boeing company. There's just a bunch of managers pontificating about what should be done. But that's really where the rubber meets the road is that we need to support these individuals. They're not asking for unreasonable. I know there's been a lot of talk about a 40% pay raise, but you have to understand over the last 10 or 12 years, they've had very, very little pay raises. And the Seattle area is a very expensive area to live, right? And if you can't pay wages, and it's not like the company's not making a fortune. I mean, we heard the salaries of the CEO, you know, he bought a brand new $4 million home and he's $20 million in his first year on the job. And yeah, I don't even know if he knows how to get to the factory from his office. So it's very frustrating.
Ed, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. That was Ed Pearson, who's Executive Director for the Foundation for Aviation Safety. He's also a former senior manager at Boeing. We did have a statement from Boeing. It said, "We've taken important steps to foster a safety culture that empowers and encourages all employees to share their voice, but it'll require continuous focus. Under the FAA's oversight, we're continuing to implement our comprehensive plan to strengthen Boeing's safety management, quality assurance and safety culture." Rania Robinson, let me come back to you first of all. I mean, you know, you're in the advertising industry. Image is everything. This is one company that has a real image problem, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, what a sort of reputational disaster. I think really it's an industry where you do rely very heavily on consumer trust or, you know, customer trust. They should be pulling everything, all the stops out really to kind of reassure people. It doesn't sound like they're doing enough really.
And this is an unusual company because, you know, you don't really have a lot of choice, do you? If you're going to fly abroad on a plane and it's on a major route, the chances are you're flying either in an Airbus or a Boeing. And if you're flying a Boeing in Europe, it's likely to be a 737 MAX, which has had, you know, appalling coverage of late. You know, it has had those very well-documented safety problems. So how do you, you know, is there a sense that customers are starting to turn against this company, that they might actually decide they don't want to fly in Boeings?
Well, I think it really depends on kind of what the customer chain, if you like, because you've got your travellers who might not necessarily always know what they're flying on, but there'll be a general concern around flying versus, you know, your more direct customer, which I guess is the airlines. So, I mean, I would imagine their market share will drop off the back of this almost certainly.
And April LaRousse, one thing we do know has been dropping, and dropping sharply since the start of the year, is Boeing's share price.
Yes, it's down 42% since the start of the year. So clearly the markets are very nervous about Boeing's inability to sort its safety issues out. And it's, you know, it's problem after problem, headline after headline. So the stock market is definitely concerned. I think the other thing that maybe people aren't aware of is they haven't paid a dividend since March 2020. So, you know, if you're an investor in Boeing shares, you've lost a lot of money and you aren't even getting a dividend. So I think they need to take some action fairly swiftly.
So it's all a big headache, isn't it, for Kelly Ortberg, who, let's not forget, he's the new chief executive of Boeing. He's only been in the job for a few weeks.
Yes, and I think first things first, sort out your strike. That's 20% of the workforce on strike. And there are estimates that say that roughly it's cost them about $570 million in costs, which is about half of their second quarter profits. So this is getting expensive. They do not want it to continue for, you know, another 13 days, which is how long it's been going so far. So I think he'll probably want to sharpen his offer.
So that would be the message from the markets. Don't hang around. Don't play hardball. Give the employees what they want.
Yes, absolutely. And as was said by your previous guest, what they're asking for is perfectly reasonable. I'm sure the company doesn't want to necessarily concede on every point. However, you can't get more critical than the people who are striking.
April, thanks very much indeed. And if you have any comments on that story or any other in this programme, don't forget, we're on 85058. We'd love to hear from you. Now, let's head to the track, shall we? Well, if that doesn't raise the hairs on the back of your neck at 5 o'clock in the morning, I don't know what will, and you're certainly not a petrol head. The Williams Formula One team used to be a giant of the sport. Back in the 80s and 90s, when I was growing up, it was winning world championships almost for fun with the likes of Nigel Mansell, Alain Prost and Damon Hill at the wheel. But over time, it lost that golden momentum and eventually became a fixture at the very back of the grid. Now it's under the ownership of a US private equity fund, Dorilton Capital. It wants to become a world beater once again. And the man in charge is James Vowles. He's ex-Mercedes-Benz. He's been there for 18 months. I asked him how long it'll take before a Williams driver is back on the top step of the podium.
The time frame I'm comfortable talking about is 27, 28, we should be able to win races again. That's the sort of timeline, which sounds awfully far ahead. There'll be people listening to this going, surely... You can see what McLaren are doing. Just copy that. It doesn't work that way. That's back into a short term. You can copy what they did in their wind tunnel 10 weeks ago. But that doesn't help you win championships. These cars evolve at such a rate that you have to be on the leading edge and pushing the boundaries. And if you're copying someone else 8 weeks ago, you'll be midfield. Because exactly to your point, if you stand still, you're going backwards. And the converse to it is this car this year, with the amount we developed it, would have been winning races last year. The development rate is enormous in our business. So answering your question, the timeline is founded around how long will it take to bring in individuals from other businesses and Formula One to come here. And Formula One is very restrictive. It's typically a two-year waiting time for your really strong individuals. Machines and infrastructure, depending on what you're investing in, can be 12 months, can be 36 months. So you have to invest in that, and it kicks in about 3 years' time. Site, exactly the same thing. So just part of what I consider the foundations will take a number of years to build. And the biggest part of that is people and culture.
But Formula One is a cutthroat business, and there are other more powerful players out there who will be ready to pounce on the talent that you bring through, who will be ready to take your sponsors. How do you deal with that?
First and foremost, transparency with all of our partners. So every single partner that I have here on my shirt, I've gone through the exact conversation I just had with you. Here's what we're laying out. This is what it looks like. We're not going to be 10th, but here's what it looks like, and here's the real steps. Do you want to be a part of our journey? Because you can come in at ground zero. And for everyone that's here, that's the journey they want. They're not interested in the final product. They're interested in aligning themselves to an organization that's prepared to take huge risks, and I'm prepared to take huge risks. If this fails, I'm in no doubt I won't be here anymore.
Formula One and motorsport in general is one of the few sectors where Britain can really genuinely claim to be world leading. What can the rest of the economy, what can other businesses learn from what's happened here in Formula One?
I think one of the key points is just how quickly you can get an organisation to move. So one of the differences, why I'm in Formula One personally, is that we will take an engineering, a complex engineering task, and give individuals 2 weeks to go and resolve it. Not 5 years, get it done. We're going to do it together. What we're very good at doing, not all teams, but I believe what we're very good at doing here in Williams, is creating a culture where failure is just part of the process, and I reward it. If you have failed, not through incompetence or negligence, but you failed because you're pushing the boundaries of innovation, pushing the boundaries of technology, I'll reward it. I'll put you up on a pedestal as long as we take that learning and feed it back into the organization, because that's how you become potent. It's the right environment to do. And I think we as Formula One, because of that very quick learning, feedback and failure loop, are very strong.
And that was James Valls, who's the head of the Williams Racing Formula One team. And I met him, incidentally, at the factory in Grove in Oxfordshire. And there you get a real impression of the history of the Williams Formula One team. They've got an internal museum with some 40 cars. I mean, there's that car that Nigel Mansell took to the 1992 World Championship. There's Ayrton Senna's last Formula One car, the late, great Ayrton Senna. The history is all there, and I think they now need to use that as motivation to get back to the front of the grid. And April LaRousse, what do you make of Formula One as a microcosm for what businesses elsewhere really need to be thinking about?
Yeah, I was listening, thinking to myself, oh, it's just like any other industry. You know, when you have times when you have less success, you have a look at your, you know, what you have to offer, your process, the way you engineer your product, and you, you know, gradually fix it. But it's not a quick fix. I think he was right to say that it'll take a few years to get to where they want to be in terms of, you know, winning competitions. But I don't think, you know, with any business you can just turn things around immediately, particularly if there's some sort of evolution of technology and development that needs to happen. I wish him luck. It's an exciting sport.
And on the wider picture, I mean, he's talking there basically about improving productivity and getting investment right. Mm-hmm. For him, the timescale is obviously shorter than for most because Formula One moves so quickly. But isn't that exactly what every business should be thinking about?
Yes. And, you know, obviously people don't make investments without an expectation of return. And unfortunately, investors don't have a huge amount of patience. Mm. So I think the challenge will be to make those two things meet.
Yes, as we said when we were discussing it, in Formula One, if you're standing still, you're moving backwards. Rania, what did you make of that?
God, I don't know anything about motorsport specifically, but I think it actually just really echo that what's already been said from a business perspective is that that kind of impatience for performance, has that been the case. And I think particularly with the challenges around kind of available investment as well these days, with the cost of borrowing and whatever else. So yeah, I think it's any transformation job is a challenge.
Okay, now just before we take a short break for the news, I just want to run past you another story. This is one for you, April. The BBC's learnt that the world's richest man, the Tesla and SpaceX boss Elon Musk, isn't being invited to the government's flagship International Investment Summit next month. He was invited by the previous government, had a fireside chat with Rishi Sunak at his own AI summit at Bletchley Park, but the new government said to be concerned about his role in sharing misinformation during last month's riots. This is a tricky one for the government, isn't it? Because Elon Musk is such a powerful man, but his influence has been questioned.
Yes, well, I'm sure he's not surprised he hasn't been invited, given what was said on X during that time of social unrest. Honestly, I don't think, you know, the previous government obviously had a different approach to how they dealt with Musk and had him come over with the thoughts of creating a factory over in the UK. I think that there'll be plenty of opportunities to find investment beyond what Elon Musk has to offer for the country. So I'm not sure it's a tremendous loss for the UK.
And Radia, I mean, what we're talking about here really is a potential image problem, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think from in terms of the advertising world and the relationship they currently have with X, it's been, you know, hugely impacted through this kind of erratic and, you know, kind of quite controversial kind of point of view that's coming through from him. So, yeah, he doesn't have a brilliant relationship with the advertising and brand world at the moment.
I think that's putting it quite mildly, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, yeah. Coming up in the second half of the programme, we will, as you know, be talking about student finances, the struggles for students and their parents when it comes to financing the cost of university. That's tuition fees, living costs, books and all the rest of it. Let us know what you think. 85058, perhaps you've got a child who's just headed off to university. You're wondering what to do with his spare room and we're wondering how it's going to affect your bank account. That's coming up in the next half of the programme.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
And now the news headlines. The UK has joined 10 other countries and the European Union in calling for a 21-day ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. The statement follows an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council during which the Secretary General said all hell is breaking loose in Lebanon. The BBC understands, as you were hearing, that one of the richest people in the world, Elon Musk, has not been invited to the government's top investment summit. Sources say it's because of the billionaire's social media posts during last month's riots, which were described at the time by ministers as utterly deplorable. Network Rail says there's been a cyber attack on the public Wi-Fi network at 20 railway stations. It's understood that customer data wasn't compromised. US media reports say the mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, is facing criminal charges. He's been under investigation for campaign funding violations, but has insisted he's done nothing wrong. Those are the latest headlines. Now let's get the weather for today. Louise Lear is at the BBC Weather Centre.
Good morning. It's all about low pressure and heavy rain as we go through the day today. It's been sweeping its way steadily north and east over the last few hours. And we'll see a weather front which will linger for much of the day across northern England and Northern Ireland. It's going to be accompanied as well by a brisk northeasterly wind. So rather cool and disappointing here. Top temperatures of 10 or 11 degrees. To the north of that, for much of central and northern Scotland, quite a lot of cloud around, but largely dry. Just a few scattered showers across the northern and Western Isles, and top temperatures of 13 Celsius. But again, still that cool northeasterly wind having quite an impact. Now, to the south of that weather front for England and Wales, it's going to be a case of sunny spells and scattered sharp showers. Some of these really quite torrential as we go through the day, possibly heavy with rumbles of thunder and some hail in there as well. So quite a lot of rain in a short space of time is possible. But dodge the showers and keep the sun. It'll be a little warmer, 14 to 18 Celsius. Now, that northerly wind will push the rain south as we go through the day on Friday. So a drier story for many. Sunny spells, scattered showers, but cooler for all. Top temperatures 9 to 13 Celsius. Louise Lear, 5 Live Weather.
Football on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Listen to exclusive live commentaries from the Premier League, Champions League and more with the 5 Live Sport Team.
He's been on the pitch for 10 seconds. Thank you very much.
Stay on top of everything football every day with the Football Daily Podcast.
This is the best central defensive partnership in European football.
His confidence levels are through the roof.
Football on 5 Live.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Wake Up to Money from BBC Radio 5 Live.
Welcome back to Wake Up to Money. It's just gone 5:30 a.m. Theo Leggett in the chair here, and it's Thursday. It's Freshers Week, but looming over the excitement for students is the fact that graduates in England leave university with average debts of around £48,500, according to the Student Loans Company. Well, these students at the University of Manchester told the BBC what they think about the growing financial pressures they're under.
I spent the past 2 years saving money at my job to save for university.
Yeah, I've managed to find a job that I'm going to start doing. I mean, it's a little bit too expensive. The student loan doesn't cover very much, so I'm going to have to survive somehow.
I mean, when I'm not trying to look at my bank account too much, to be honest, when timetables and when fresh is over, I think then I'm going to have a more regular budget, because right now it's quite random, everything which is going on. From then onwards, I'm much more looking at organising my money and exactly how much I want to spend where.
Well, like a good student, I'm looking at the figures here, and one in seven students say they're seriously thinking about dropping out of university this year because they simply can't afford it. And four in five students are experiencing significant stress due to money worries. That's according to new data from Experian. But what about the parents who might be helping to finance these freshers through what's known as the Bank of Mum and Dad? They are expected to be contributing. Tony got in touch with our colleagues over at Radio 4's Moneybox to tell them he's feeling pretty squeezed.
I've currently got two sons at university. The first got an apprenticeship. He's staying at home, so actually he's financially in quite a good place. My second son's just started business management at University of Plymouth. He did question whether to go, and the debt he was going to get himself into. He has got a plan to get a job to try and help mitigate that cost, but hasn't got one yet, so it's down to the bank of Mum and Dad. And even then, it's not really enough to cover the costs. And then in addition to that, we've got another two boys. So what happens when they come along and they decide they want to go to university or not?
Well, joining me now is Sarah Atkinson, who's Chief Executive of the Social Mobility Foundation. Let's look first at the idea of students dropping out. Where are we seeing that happening? Is it in particular subjects? Is there a particular area where there's a problem?
Yeah, Theo, so financial pressures do have a big impact on students completing courses. And the area that this has most pressure is on students from low-income families. So students who've been eligible for free school meals, nearly 20% of them don't complete their course. And we know that financial pressures are a significant driver on that. So it is a real problem.
And this, as you're saying, it hits the poorest students hardest.
It absolutely does. We know that students on low income are less likely to get places at university. But we know if they are studying at university, they're more likely to be studying at home because of financial constraints. They're more likely to be working long hours outside of their studies, upwards of 20 hours for students on low incomes. That really impacts what we call the student experience, their academic study, and also the other things around that, the enrichment that makes university fulfilling. So it really does contribute to student stress and to dropout rates.
So even though we've been talking about the levels of debt that students run up while they're at university, I mean, that figure of £48,000, what you're saying is that even that isn't enough.
That's right. Students outside of London, living away from home, the maximum maintenance that they can get is less than £10,000 a year. And we know that just the essentials for those group of students typically cost more than £11,000. So there is a gap, a cost of living gap for students. And we're talking essentials here, accommodation, food, travel to get to the university. There is a gap for those students, which in those cases, Bank of Mum and Dad is not an option.
And that's the point, isn't it? The level at which these loans are set, the amount that you can get, that does assume that parents are chipping in.
That's right. There's assumptions that parents will be able to help. There's assumptions that students will be able to work in the holidays or during term time. That's reasonable, of course, but long working hours can really impact on students' experience. We haven't seen a change since 2008 to the household income level at which you qualify for the maximum level of support. It's £25,000 a year, which means in real terms that period, that's gone down by 40%. So students on low incomes may not be eligible for that full level of support for their maintenance. That's impacting on the squeezed middle, of course, as well. If things had changed with inflation, we'd be talking about nearly £33,000 a year. So there's a big gap in that loan entitlement.
And the expectation on parents, I mean, I've got two teenage kids who will be going to university in the coming years, I hope, and I'm already having panic attacks about how I'm going to finance that. And I'm on a reasonable salary. How much strain are parents feeling at this stage?
Yeah, so parents want the best for their children, for their young people. University and higher education is not the right path for everyone. For very many people, it's part of the aspiration for a better future earning potential and for education fulfilment, building of people's capacity. So people want this for their young people. But when you come to look at the figures, for many people, it's either too tight to manage at all Or, yeah, as you said, it can contribute significant stress on a family where other cost of living pressures, of course, are also being felt.
So when it all becomes too much and people can't complete their courses or can't go to university, what are the consequences of that? Because, you know, we need skilled workers for a start, don't we?
Exactly right. That we think, of course, about the impact on the individual, and that impact is very serious. The mental health impact, the career earnings impact for those individuals of dropping out of university. But it's also an enormous waste of resources and potential. Young people from low-income backgrounds are not less likely to be talented, not less likely to be able to earn and contribute. And we need those critical skills. We've been talking all week in politics about the importance of growing skills from within our country, within our potential. So yeah, there's a cost to all of us from wasting that potential.
We haven't even discussed yet that colossal level of debt, £48,000. Now, student loans vary from region to region in the country. And, you know, I think at the moment, after 40 years, if you're in England, if you still got loan outstanding, you don't have to pay it back. So it's not quite as bad as it seems, but it's still quite daunting, isn't it, for somebody who's 18, 19, going to university and seeing these numbers mounting up?
Yes. So the cost of tuition, which you're talking about there, rather than the kind of immediate cost of maintenance, all the evidence says that that impacts less on people's willingness and aspiration to study at university. But nonetheless, the complexity of it, and for some families, concerns about debt, which, you know, debt in some families is a real and present stress. So absolutely, it contributes to the complex picture.
Sarah, thank you very much indeed. That was Sarah Atkinson, Chief Executive of the Social Mobility Foundation. April, as we said at the top of the programme, you've got a particular interest in this, haven't you?
I very much do. My daughter just started the University of Leeds, so it's her Freshers Week.
And I think you've got another child at university
Edinburgh.
As well?
Yes, up in University of Edinburgh. So I have been through this, I'm going through this, and I can see that things are more expensive than you imagine. And, you know, what can you do? They're living away from home. They're obviously enjoying life. Everything's expensive, from food to going out, just to getting life set up away from home. They are working their way through that. But thankfully, I am able to be Bank of Mom. But there are plenty of people out there who aren't. And that is the challenge.
So have you been supporting them in other ways? You know, you have to give them money. Do you buy certain things for them? I mean, how do you make this work as a family?
Yeah, well, both of them, the one in Edinburgh has been working throughout her university time. So getting, part-time jobs to support. The younger one who just started in Leeds, she wants to get some sort of work. The challenge will be how to fit it around the coursework. To make sure that it doesn't get in the way of studies. But I think that is going to have to be the way through, because obviously, of course, we give them money to spend, but money never goes quite as far as you would like it to. And I think they want to find ways to earn their own keep to some degree.
And there is the other side of this, isn't there? We're talking about everything from the student perspective, and that's really understandable. But, you know, also, the universities themselves, they're struggling for money as well. I mean, they want to increase fees.
Yes, and actually, I mean, you can probably hear in my accent, American. University in America is incredibly expensive. It's around £38,000 equivalent tuition per annum. So that obviously is considerably higher than the £9,300 tuition here. But it is, I can see why the universities are saying we're simply not able to charge enough to cover costs, particularly as they have to offer a broad range of courses where they don't necessarily get the same amount of student interest. So if you want to offer all of the different subjects, you need potentially to charge a little more on that tuition, which is going to be very difficult.
Rania Robinson, Chief Executive of Quiet Storm, you're still with us. I'd just like to bring you in here. What do you make of all of this?
Well, I've got a very different perspective on this, as a sort of from a number of levels, really. One, I didn't go to university, so I don't feel like, you know, from my personal experience, I think you can succeed without having a degree, even more so today. As a parent who's got two teenagers, one of which has decided to go, he's gone to film school. It's a school that's been funded by the industry, which just gets kids straight into the workplace because they recognize that actually the universities aren't necessarily getting them students out that are coming out with the necessary skills. I think industry and the business environment is evolving and changing at a much faster pace than education. So actually there's not necessarily, you're not necessarily coming out with the skills that are needed for the, for today's workplace. And then thirdly, as an employer who also is recognizing, we're seeing this even with some of the big employers like Google and Ernst Young, who are opting for taking kids straight out of school, is that we're not necessarily getting young people out of universities fit for the workplace. So I actually think it's changing, and I think that's a really positive thing, because what it does is it takes out this barrier for disadvantaged young people and actually gets people into work and actually experiencing getting experience that's much more relevant to the workplace today. And that's not obviously true for every profession, but certainly certain industries there's a disconnect, I think. So actually, I'm embracing that and feel very good that I think we need richer apprenticeship schemes. We need more businesses looking at hiring in different kinds of ways, because we know now that even if you have gone to university, there's no guarantee of a job at the end of it. There's lots of graduates coming out, not necessarily getting jobs, but with huge amounts of debt.
I'm interested that you should say that, Rania, because we've just had a text in from Brendan from Newark in Nottinghamshire, and he says, good morning. In my opinion, we have too many young people unnecessarily going to university. We need more young people going straight to work, either as an employee or apprentice. The reality is too many young people are going to university for the crack and the experience, but at an unnecessary expense to the government, themselves and their families. So is that the answer? We should get away from the mentality of thinking that everybody has to go to university.
I absolutely think so. And I think, from my own experience as an employer, it's not a guarantee to have somebody come in and be brilliant in the workplace. They're very different skill sets, to be honest with you, academic learning versus on-the-job learning. So obviously it depends on what industry and what profession, but I think things have moved on, things have evolved, and I'm not sure the education system has kept up.
Rania, thank you on that. Now, I said earlier in the programme that we were going to talk about consumer confidence, and this is another indication that people are feeling gloomy about their finances. New data from the British Retail Consortium shows that consumer confidence has fallen significantly in September ahead of the Chancellor's budget at the end of October. And that follows last week's data from GfK's Consumer Confidence Index, again showing that consumer confidence fell sharply this month. All five measures, such as savings, making big purchases, and just general financial outlook, were down. April, this does seem to paint a pretty bleak picture of how people are feeling towards their money and the future.
Yes, and I think when you look at consumer confidence measures across the developed markets, it's all looking pretty similar. Consumers have been really hit hard by the fact that their income just doesn't go very far, after the inflation hit that we all had. Prices are higher and salaries did not keep pace with that. So it's really not surprising that we are seeing these sort of confidence numbers looking quite soggy, really. And there's really not a whole lot one can do about that. I mean, wages are trying to catch up to restore people's purchasing power. But, as you heard from the Boeing strike, employers are not really wanting to make up that loss. Obviously, it's hard on businesses. I can see the government obviously wanting to give more money to some public sector workers as well, but that too is a slow process. Things are more difficult, and therefore we're all thinking very carefully about how we're spending our money in terms of items that we don't necessarily need but maybe want. Maybe you just decide to put off some of those purchases until you feel as though you're on a more stable footing.
And another issue I think you've been looking at, April, the BRC also says the broken business rate system is currently holding back investment in jobs and communities across the retail industry. Does that match what you're seeing?
Yes, I think this has been an issue for years that, you know, the rate system needs to be looked at. If you want to have high street full of actually, you know, sort of smaller or medium-sized businesses and not just chain businesses or large businesses, you actually need to find a way of adjusting how those business rates are calculated. And I believe that this government will be looking comprehensively at the entire tax policy and perhaps make some much needed reforms. But I would like my local high street to have some more vibrancy, and that's one way to do it.
And Rania, as head of an advertising agency, I mean, confidence is what you're all about, really, isn't it? Are you seeing this lack of confidence?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like as I said earlier, we are seeing more movement, which is generally what happens is there's a kind of direct correlation with consumer confidence and brand investment in advertising. I think because this has been, it's been stagnant for so long now, I think brands have been sort of sitting on their hands. But what we're seeing, I think, now is even though the consumer confidence is still a bit shaky, that is that the brands are just now kind of getting to a point where they're going back out and investing, because we still don't know how long this market's going to be like this and the environment's going to be like this. So I think there's definitely a kind of sense of, okay, let's just do stuff now, which is good. I think we know that brands who invest in downturns at this time, they kind of get the exponential benefit of that when consumer confidence does go back up. So it's a smart move for brands. So we I think
trying to build up confidence rather than waiting for confidence to build itself.
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, another story that's in the news today is Rightmove has rejected a third offer from Rupert Murdoch's REA Group, saying its latest £6.1 billion bid is, quote, unattractive. But that is a £500 million increase on the first bid made for the UK's largest online property portal at the start of the month. April, you know, REA wants Rightmove, but Rightmove clearly thinks that's the wrong move for the company and for shareholders.
Yes, indeed. Or they're just waiting for a better offer. Yes, I mean, clearly REA is dead keen on buying Rightmove. And, you know, you can understand it's obviously got a very strong position in the UK, and REA Group want to have a larger presence for their sort of online estate agency business. The thing that REA do very well is they offer more than just a site to be able to look for property to buy. They also offer financial services, such as mortgage broker services, and they provide data on what's going on in property markets, and they sell that data. So that's another business stream. So actually, the REA Group is really quite a vibrant business. It's had a really great share price performance as well. So, you know, they've got money to spend. They're looking at Rightmove and saying, ah, here's a business where we could actually do more in the UK than they're already doing. And we've already got a really strong business to start with. So we'll see whether they can find a price that actually is sufficiently high to tempt the Rightmove, management.
But they've got one more chance here, haven't they? They're three bids in. They can make another bid. After that, I think they have to wait for another 6 months before they can bid again. I mean, what's holding them back? Why not just seize the bull by the horns, go direct to shareholders and make a bid they can't refuse?
Well, I suppose they think they're going to get a better deal if they do it this way. You know, they may change tack and actually be slightly more aggressive. But at this stage, I think they'd quite like to not overpay and be able to continue with their business expansion. So watching carefully to see how this evolves.
And Rania, what do you make of it?
Well, I mean, I think the property market's been quite resilient, hasn't it, despite everything? So it does feel like a smart investment. Yeah, and I think we keep sort of anticipating and imagining kind of shifts in the market, but it has been resilient. So, yeah, feels like a smart move.
Okay, now, we were talking earlier in the programme about students and student life and student debt and quite a lot of that. Now, my memories of being a student, a lot of them revolve around pot noodles late at night. And if you're one of my generation, you'll know exactly what I mean. But the idea of instant noodles as a quick fix, some instant calories, it's getting, I think, at the moment, a little bit of a revamp, and it's thanks to TikTok. So we're seeing a resurgence of ramen noodles, the instant noodles that you can cook quickly, being marketed to Gen Z as more authentic and proper haute cuisine. The social media trend behind the growing sales sees TikTok users try and make their instant noodles a bit fancy by adding extra ingredients to them, such as egg and chili, and I was looking at all sorts of weird and wonderful recipes before coming on air. And it does seem all of that is having an impact. Sales of instant noodles have risen by 50% year on year on Ocado's website, while searches for ramen noodles have jumped by 35%. I'm joined now by Nicola Waller, who's buying director at Ocado Retailer. Good morning, Nicola.
Good morning, Theo. I'm too the generation that grew up in student years on pot noodles, so I can relate to that totally.
What was your favourite flavour?
I think I like the chilli, but I've got teenage children and I've recently rediscovered that actually the chicken and mushroom wasn't bad at all. Who knew?
I was into the chicken curry ones myself. Yeah. They didn't taste like curry. I'm not sure what they tasted like, but they were edible. Anyway, Ocado's seen a 50% jump in sales of instant noodles. So, you know, we've been talking about the TikTok element. What other elements are contributing to this?
I mean, I think people are looking for inspiration. They're looking for, we've seen a rise in the ramen restaurants across the UK. And I think people are really looking for inspiration. It's reasonable, it's convenient, it's available, you know, a packet of noodle would start at 60p. And therefore, they're looking to recreate some of those ramen bowls at home and really just make dinner a little bit more interesting at times.
But still, the fundamental point about these dishes is that they're cheap, isn't it?
Yep. They're cheap, they're convenient. But actually, by adding some flavour hacks, adding some protein, they can very quickly be very nutritious and very interesting and quite Instagrammable, which is, you know, we're also seeing people picking up their phones before they're picking up their knives and forks. So that is definitely a trend. The other thing that we're seeing on TikTok is the viral carbonara ramen. I never thought it took that long to make a carbonara, a pasta carbonara, but a carbonara ramen you can do even quicker because you haven't even got to wait for the pasta to boil. So we're definitely seeing content on TikTok driving sales and searches amongst Ocado.
Now, this has been kicked off to a certain extent by social media trends on TikTok. Are you finding more and more that you're having to be reactive, that a trend comes up and that suddenly you're having to buy in more stock because the students are out buying ramen noodles or whatever?
Absolutely. We immediately see in our search, and that for us is the joy of Ocado. We can see what our customers are looking for, sometimes even before they knew they were looking for it. And once we see those search terms peaking, we will make sure that we, amongst the buying team, are either going out and procuring new products. If they're looking for things that we don't stock, we do have over 50,000 products on our website. But then also making sure, exactly as you say, that we're buying it in the quantities that the customer is searching.
Nicola Waller, buying director at Ocado Retail, thank you very much indeed. April LaRousse, let's go back to you. I mean, you've got your daughter in first week at university, another one at Edinburgh. Are they fans of the ramen noodle trend?
They absolutely are. In fact, they were already adding things to make ramen noodles more exciting and interesting before TikTok was suggesting it. So, yeah, I'm not surprised. Honestly, it is so easy and quick. And yeah, as was already said, very cost effective. I think it makes sense that you know, people are, especially in these difficult times from a cost of living perspective, exploring the joys of ramen noodles.
Give me a favourite recipe.
My younger daughter's very interested in putting things like tofu and sriracha sauce into a ramen noodle dish.
Is that something that would whet your appetite?
Actually, I can't even have ramen noodles because I'm not allowed to have gluten. So, unfortunately for me, it's not on the menu, but they are absolutely enjoying them.
But you get the benefits because you are struggling to finance two kids for university. And ramen noodles, as we were just hearing from Nicola, they are cheap. Rania, I just want to bring you in at the end here. I mean, pot noodle, ramen noodle, cheap food. What do you think?
Well, I'm seeing it cross-generationally in my household. So my 17-year-old son is doing it, and as is my husband. So I don't think it's exclusive to Gen Z. I think it's, in my husband's case, I mean, he's not on TikTok in the same way as my, well, you know, even my son's not hugely, massively, sort of unusually not on, crazily on TikTok either. But I think it's just the whole ramen culture and how you can
Rania,
just,
we're going to have to leave it there. Okay. So unfortunately, yep. We've reached the end of the programme. So thank you to Rania Robinson, Chief Executive of Quiet Storm, and April LaRousse of Insight Investments. That's it for Wake Up to Money. Now, it's Rachel and Claire on Five Live Breakfast this morning. Good morning.
Thanks, Theo. Morning, everyone. And coming up on Five Live Breakfast, the UK has joined 10 other countries in calling for a 21-day ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah.
Liverpool thrashed West Ham and Arsenal beat Bolton to progress in the League Cup.
And this is exciting. The Earth is going to briefly gain a second moon. We'll tell you why, how, in a few minutes.
The Voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Breakfast.
Right, let's start with the main news this morning. The UK has joined 10 other countries and the European Union in calling for a 21-day ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. It's hoped it will give time for further talks aimed at ending the conflict taking place on the Israel-Lebanon border. The statement followed an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council in New York. Antonio Guterres is the UN Secretary General.
Hell is breaking loose in Lebanon. We should all be alarmed by the escalation. Lebanon is at the brink. Since October, nearly 200,000 people within Lebanon and over 60,000 from northern Israel have fled their homes. Many lives have been lost. All these must stop.
The BBC has heard harrowing testimony from a woman who said she was raped by the former owner of Harrods, Mohammed Al-Fayed, when she was 16, after being made to have intrusive medical examinations. Kate, which isn't her real name, is one of five women who has revealed details of a serious sexual attack to a BBC documentary team. Our reporter Helena Wilkinson, from her now, contains details of a serious sexual nature.
When Kate started working for Al-Fayed, she said he asked her whether she was sexually active. He discovered she was a virgin. She said a medical was arranged for her with Dr. Anne Coxon, who asked to do an internal examination and test for sexually transmitted diseases, even though Kate said she wasn't sexually active. On her return to the office, Kate said Al-Fayed discussed intimate details about the medical. She said he summoned her one night to his apartment, where he raped her. The BBC has contacted Dr. Coxon and Harrods for comment, but so far has had no response from either.
Harrods' new owners have previously apologised unreservedly and said the actions of Mohammed Al-Fayed were that of an individual intent on abusing his power.
Network Rail says there's been a cyber attack on the public Wi-Fi network at 20 railway stations.